Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Hello, Houston. Alongside Clint Sterner and Wade Smith, I'm Jeremy Branham. We're one day away from the biggest game of the year. It's not just the biggest game of the year because it's the next game on the schedule, but it's the biggest game of the year for the Houston Texans. Not only is it the biggest game of the year for the Houston Texans, but it's the biggest game on the schedule this week. Aaron Schatz sent out the playoff odds, the implications, what a win and a loss would be for every playoff every matchup in the NFL this week. The Texans' playoff odds, if they win or lose this game, 43% in the balance for Indianapolis, 38% in the balance for the Houston Texans. That's how big the swing is for tomorrow night's game.
Big-time game. I mean, look, we've mentioned it multiple times about big-time games, must-win type games, and we always want to attach an if to it, which I think is correct. So you got to somewhat explain yourself. There's really no need to attach an if to this one here. I mean, clearly it's very obvious why this is a big game. You've positioned yourself with last week's loss to where this game means even more than it already did. And given what happened earlier in the season, 6 weeks ago with the loss to the Colts, obviously it's a big game. And then, as you mentioned, the playoff implications are absolutely huge. And this team, this head coach, this GM, they're in a position where the moves they've made, they cannot afford to go backwards. It's unacceptable to go backwards on the season. And so this game right here is really a tell-all, whether you take a step forward from 2018 or do you sit idle or backslide from 2018. We'll see. Thursday night, it's on and popping, Wade Smith.
I tell you what, man, Whitney Mercilus came out early on this week and he said this is a must-win ball game. And when you hear players early on in the week saying, even using that term, must-win ball game, you know that this is a big deal. And so the Texans are going to have to go out there and play a game that they haven't played against the Indianapolis Colts in a couple of years now. I mean, every time I look up, the Texans play the Colts, and the Colts have their number. The only time that the Texans beat the Colts was in 17, or was that 17 or last year? It was the first game when Frank Reich went for
– Yeah, it was last year.
It was last year. So it was the first time they played them last year. Yeah, and so that game, you really look at it, it should have been a tie at worst for the Colts. And so – you know, they pretty much gave that game away. But every game since then, the Colts have pretty much dominated. And when I say dominated, they took control of games early on, and they held leads throughout. And so the Texans are going to have to play fast, and they're going to have to start better than they've started all year long in order to come out with a W.
It sounds like a stupid question, but why have the Colts been able to beat up on the Texans these last 2 years? I mean, we talk about all the time that it seems like the Texans have the better roster, especially when Andrew Luck is not around, that you have Jacoby Brissett. So why is it that the Texans were beat up in Indy earlier this season? Why was it that they were trailing 21-0 at halftime in the wild card round at NRG Stadium last year in the playoffs? What is it about Frank Reich that has they have the Texans number for whatever reason?
To me, this is one of very few teams in this league that they force you to play a clean style of football. They magnify your mistakes. New England's that way. They've been that way forever with Belichick. They just minimize their mistakes, and when you make a mistake, they bet on going into the game that you're going to make more mistakes than them and that they're going to be able to overcome and capitalize on those mistakes. Baltimore is a team that does exactly that. Now, those are your top two. Indy is a team that, for whatever reason, again, I don't buy the Indianapolis Colts relative to competing in the playoffs and potentially being a Super Bowl caliber team anytime soon. But they are very, very well coached. The team as a whole is bought into running the football, stopping the run, minimizing mistakes, and forcing you into situations where when you make mistakes, they're going to capitalize on it. And there's just very few teams that are very, very good at that. The Colts are very, very good at simply doing that, chewing up the clock. All the basic football coach speak that we hear, convert, stay in, you know, be good on first and second down so that third downs are better. Don't turn the football over. Don't beat yourself with penalties. When you get in the red zone, no sacks, no turnovers, no penalties. Those are things that start fast. Come out of the locker room in the first drive of both the game and the second half. Those are things that they do really, really well. And if the Texans don't clean it up, they're going to be in another tough spot on Thursday night versus the Colts because they're not changing their stripes. They're going to do that. That's one thing you can take to the bank. The Colts are going to do that. They're going to play a clean style of ball and force you to be better than them.
Whenever you look at the Texans, if they win this game 7-4, they're in a good spot, right? They'll be 7-4. They'll be a game ahead of Indianapolis in the AFC South, and they'll also gain ground over the other contenders for the wild card spots in the AFC. They lose, all of a sudden you're 6-5. You drop below Oakland, who'd be 6-4. They still have a game on Sunday. Pittsburgh and Tennessee, they're in the mix as well, 5-5. Remember, you play the Titans twice in the final 4 weeks of the season, and the Browns are still lingering as well at 4-6. So you win this game, you're in a good spot from a playoff perspective. You lose this game, you have a lot of work to do in the final five games. So that's what adds to it, the importance of Thursday Night Football.
Think about that, guys. Let's think about it from a fan base standpoint. If you lose this football game, you're in a dogfight with Oakland, who was the laughing stock of the NFL 2 months ago when AB and Mac Mayock and John Gruden were doing their thing, trying to figure out whether he was going to be a fit or not. It was a laughing stock of the NFL. Yep. To think that if the Texans lose Thursday night, they are not in a neck-to-neck race with not only in a neck-to-neck race with Oakland for a wild card spot. If you really look at it, Oakland's trending up, and Houston would be trending down at that point in time. That's going to be a very, very tough one for the fan base in Houston to swallow if the Texans don't take care of business Thursday night.
And you look at the rest of – go ahead.
No, but what I was about to say is this. Listen, the Texans are built this year to not be a 6-5 team. They're built this Correct. Year to compete with the big boys. That's why last week was so disappointing playing against the Baltimore Ravens, is because they built this team to compete with the big boys. And early on in the year, they won games against the Chargers, and now it doesn't look as good as a win as it did at the time. But at the time, that was a legit win. They went on the road and beat the Chiefs. They won some games where you said to yourself, all right, we can compete with the big boys now. Well, now what you did against the Ravens is put you back down on that level that people thought that you were going to be. But you've invested too much in this roster with trades, with free agent signings, when you have a bunch of guys on one-year deals. You're supposed to get it done this season. So this is a must-win game, not just for this season and them trying to win the division and actually compete for a Super Bowl, but it's a must-win to prove up all the investment that you've put in constructing the roster for this one season.
To make matters worse, too, is that you'd be a game behind the Colts. They would have the tiebreakers. You'd have to basically make up two games in ground to overpass them in the AFC South standings. The Colts rest of the schedule after Thursday. Titans at home, at Tampa, at the Saints. That's a tough one. Home for Carolina at Jacksonville. The Colts would be favored in four of their final five games, and you would need to make up two games. So that's what adds to the importance of Thursday Night Football. Must win if you want to be AFC South champions, in my mind. You can still sneak into a wild card if you don't win tomorrow night, but you can pretty much kiss the division goodbye.
Well, I mean, you talk about limping into the playoffs and in a wild card. And now, to me, you know, I mentioned this earlier, Wade, is in the year, maybe hell, it may have been last year, but we've talked about it at some point in time, is I really don't care about how you get there. Like, I don't care what the record is, man.
Right.
It's the product. Like, if you could be sitting where you're sitting right now and had put a good product on the field last week versus Baltimore, and the feeling is totally different, right? I don't care if you limp in the playoffs by beating Oakland, or I guess winning in the wild card race versus Oakland, I'm okay with that. But the product cannot be what we watched last Sunday. The product on the field has to be significantly, significantly better. And if it is, then Indy shouldn't stay on the field with you Thursday night. I mean, that's the truth of the matter, is at what Wade just mentioned with the roster, the talent that's on this team, if you go out there and put a good product on the field, last week would have been a lot more respectable. Right, and Indy won't be able to stay on the field with you. That's the truth of the matter. If Indy stays on the field with the Texans, it's because of plan, it's because of execution, it's because of poor quarterback play, it's because of penalties in inopportune times. It's self-inflicted wounds if Indianapolis Colts are able to stay on the field with the Texans.
To make matters worse, T.Y. Hilton was estimated as a full participant today on the Colts injury report. Short week Thursday, there's no real practices, so you give an estimate based on what you think they would have done. They think he would have been a full participant in practice today. He has a questionable tag, so We heard Romeo Crennel yesterday say, oh, T.Y. Hilton's going to play. The injury report that came out an hour ago from the Colts shows that, yeah, T.Y. Hilton probably going to play. And he's been a problem. He's been a thorn in the Texans' side over the course of his career.
Yeah, absolutely he has. I mean, I think, and I don't know exactly, you know, what the plan would be versus T.Y. Hilton. I think it depends on who's healthy for the Texans and who's not. And whether you slant the coverage, tilt the coverage to him, and then man up the backside or vice versa. I don't know exactly the severity of his injury, but I know this. We talked a lot last week about the Texans, the ability, the need to really punish Lamar Jackson play to play was going to be important. I think punishing and being physical and disruptive with T.Y. Hilton at the line of scrimmage early in this football game could be a big key for the Texans.
I tell you what, man, to me, this game is not on the defense of the Houston Texans. This game is on the offense of the Houston Texans because the way they're constructed, the way that they're built, and the fact that they have so many injuries on the defensive side of the ball, key spots, J.J. Watt, the DBs, you know, Justin Reed's not going to play, all these type of things that are going on with the defense. The offense has to play up to their capabilities because if they do, they'll outscore the Colts. But if they don't, I can't sit here and expect the Texans to generate a pass rush when the Colts have that O-line that they have. They'll keep seven guys in there to protect, and you'll let your receivers run those deep routes that take forever to uncover, but he has time to do it, and then T.Y. Hilton makes plays down the field. That's kind of been the story that you've seen the past four, five, six, seven, eight times that the Texans have played against the Colts. But the times that they beat them is because the offense comes to play. And so, to me, this game is squarely at the feet of the offense and what they can do against the Indianapolis Colts.
Every side of the ball to blame in the 41-7 loss against Baltimore. But I thought in that game, the offense put the defense in really bad spots, really from the start. Deshaun Watson fumbling near midfield. They were able to get a stand and keep Baltimore off the board. The turnover on downs in the second possession. Like, the defense was pressed the entire game. And then once the dam broke, that's when you saw Baltimore start to rack up the yards and rack up the points.
JB, think about it. 10 drives, 3 turnovers, 3 points on the season. You think about that from a defensive perspective. You've played Drew Brees. You've played Pat Mahomes. You've played Phillip Rivers. You've played Lamar Jackson. You've played Derek Carr. You played some pretty damn good quarterbacks to go out there and for the offense to lay an egg on the first drive. And possibly if the defense doesn't bow its neck immediately out of the locker room, if the defense slips up at all, it's a 3-0 or a 7-0 deficit the Texans are playing from immediately. That's a lot of pressure over a 10-game span for the defense. That trend has to change moving forward. It doesn't matter if they limp in the playoffs. It don't matter if they win a division. When they go to face New England, when they go to face – high caliber opponents, they're not going to win football games. They're not going to consistently win those football games. So they got to clean that up first and foremost.
Clint Sterner, Wade Smith, Jeremy Branham. Coming up next, Jim Crane speaks for the first time since the Astros cheating allegations. What did he say? Find out next on Houston Sports Leader, Sports Radio 610. Clint Sterner, Wade Smith, Jeremy Branham on Sports Radio 610. Major League Baseball is in Arlington for their owners' meetings. They could have picked a better place than Arlington for their owners' meetings. Looking at you, Wade Smith. But the Jim Crane was there today. The reporters from Major League Baseball were there today. They wanted to talk to Jim Crane today about the Astros cheating allegations. Jim Crane has not, prior to today, said a word since the cheating allegations came out. Here's a few reports from reporters around Major League Baseball. Laura Albanese, Astros owner Jim Crane is sitting about 30 feet away. We're not allowed to approach him, can't approach any owners during the owners meeting, by the way. So this wasn't just Jim Crane. There was a sheriff and constable standing in between the media and the Astros owner. He'll get to decide whether he wants to speak about the cheating allegation soon. Later, Jim Crane declined comment. If you want to talk about baseball, I'll talk about baseball. Before he can say another word, the sheriff cuts through us and escorts him away. This from Jeff Paston of Sports Illustrated. Houston Astros owner Jim Crane just walked through the lobby at the owners' meetings and said, if you want to talk about baseball, I'll talk about baseball. What else do you want to talk about? Any other issues? At which point, two police officers escort him away. Chandler Rome of the Houston Chronicle, who covers the Astros, full exchange with Jim Crane. Do you have a few minutes to talk? They ask Crane. If you want to talk about baseball, I'll talk about baseball. What else do you want to talk about? Reporters, so you have no comment on? And then he was interrupted by Crane. Any other issues before two police officers intervened? So Jim Crane's first comments about the Astros cheating allegations, just wanted to talk baseball. He got cut off by the two cops as they escorted him out in Arlington.
Yeah, look, to me, that's one of those things where I have a hard time understanding why when he, and I get why the media, we have to do our job and we have to ask questions regardless of what the coach or the owner, I guess regardless of how he opens. But I would err if I were there asking questions immediately when he said, I will take questions about baseball. I would not attempt to ask a question about anything other than baseball at that point in time. So I really struggle being in the media of crossing that line of like, why understanding why guys in the media would do that, knowing that what he's talking about is specifically, he's not going to answer any questions about the electronic stealing of signs that the Astros are accused of at this point in time. I've always struggled with that aspect of media.
I find it interesting that the police was so quick to escort him away. To me, it seems like the Major League Baseball and the owners have some type of agreement to, hey, we're not going to address this issue until it gets further, like fully vetted out and investigated. So don't even, because I don't want you to say anything that's going to be inflammatory or be on the wrong side of what it ends up being. And I don't want you to bring any more negative issues or press to this situation. It's just bad PR altogether. So it's like, you know, you're going to talk baseball and that's it. And I don't know if it's a command from on high or what, but I just find it interesting because it sounded like to me from the exchange, Crane was about to respond back and the police were like, nah. So right. And they escorted him away. Like, we're not going to go there. And so that just lets you know the severity of the situation. It lets you know the magnitude of what's going on and what it means, not just for the Astros, but for Major League Baseball in general. And so when you look at what the investigation is going to end up doing to the Houston Astros, you got to believe that if there's anything that comes out that it's true that the Astros did something that was nefarious, that the consequences are going to be severe. And that's something that you got to be really concerned about if you're an Astros fan.
One of the things, too, that we Manfred's comments yesterday, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, he said that this investigation, he's not looking at anybody else. He's looking at the Houston Astros. Well, Ken Rosenthal wrote a piece, and Ken Rosenthal has been behind all of this. Ken Rosenthal's article is what started all of the Astros allegations, and then it's kind of snowballed. I wouldn't call it out of control because it seems like where there is smoke, there's fire. Some of the theories out there are pretty crazy and seem to be, you know, pretty far-fetched and probably not true, but it does look like there's something going on with the Houston Astros, whether it's foul play since 2017. We'll wait to see what Major League Baseball undercovers, but Ken Rosenthal took exception to Robert Manfred's comments yesterday saying that this was only an Astros deal. Like the Red Sox, they cheated with the Apple Watch. Other teams have complained about other teams cheating in baseball. And Rosenthal said that it isn't just an Astros problem. And after Manfred's comments yesterday, that they should be looking into other teams other than the Astros. So it seems like this whole investigation, just looking at it from the surface level of what Manfred said yesterday, of what the guy Ken Rosenthal who broke this story and now is still reporting on it, it seems like it's just a giant mess right now.
Well, I mean, we're Major League Baseball, and it is going to have some serious problems is the fact that it happened in 2017. In 2019, it's all coming to light.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like at what point, I mean, were you just going to sweep it all under the rug, tweak the rules a little bit and move forward and expect nobody to say anything? And so Major League Baseball, and I don't know if there's any harm in doing that. I don't know if there were any rules broken, but it sure is suspicious that that Major League Baseball waited this long after tweaking rules to explain why they tweaked those rules. And it took the Astros essentially being called out for Major League Baseball to explain what all went on back in 2017.
It's most definitely in Major League Baseball's best interest if they can just focus all the negative energy and negative press towards one organization as opposed to it being a widespread thing around their league. Because if it's widespread, then it calls in question just the integrity of the league and what's going on there. You got a bunch of teams that are cheating per se. Now Major League Baseball looks like, okay, they allow this type of things to occur on their watch. Now, if it's just one organization, Major League Baseball, I think it's in their best interest to say it's just the Astros, because if they say that it's more than that, then it makes them look worse. And so the commissioner comes out and says, you know what? Yeah, it's just the Astros. You have reporters saying, no, it's more than that. And it'll be interesting to see what ends up being the final prognosis. And it could be a situation where all along, Ken Rosenthal is coming out saying, you know what, it's been multiple teams, but the Major League Baseball might find, like, you know what, we're going to leave those teams out of it. We're going to focus all our attention on the Astros. They're going to take this, the brunt of this, and then we're going to move on and sweep everything else under the rug. That's what it seems like it's going to be.
It reeks of the save your ass situation, right? One of those types. It reeks of Major League Baseball's trying their damnedest to keep this thing between the lines and move beyond it, instead of doing a full-blown investigation, including every Major League Baseball team out there. But we'll see. Nonetheless, we're speculating at this point. We'll see what comes of it.
That's my stance, too. We'll see what happens with the Astros are concerned. But going forward, just allow the pitcher and the catcher to have some sort of communication device, like you see from play callers and quarterbacks, play callers and middle linebackers or whatever, and just communicate the pitch verbally. Figure out a way where you can eliminate technology stealing signs, and you can give everybody the peace of mind. Clint Sterner, Wade Smith, Jeremy Branham. Clint, I saw you watching film of the Texans this past week against Baltimore. I don't know why you do that to yourself after they lost 41-7, but what were some things that you noticed as you reviewed it all?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the critical points in that first quarter were very telling. I mean, I think the fourth down play was very vanilla, very elementary, not real sure schematically what they were trying to get accomplished there. And you play man across the board. You got two in-breaking routes where the underneath route is Kiki QT, and he's running like a little whip action. And I understand they're trying to pull out the underneath coverage and hit DeAndre Hopkins over the top on that play, but it takes a little bit of time there for that to be executed properly and for the quarterback to process it and get the football out. They've had a ton of success moving hop pre-snap and giving Watson immediate, clean, quick looks to get the football out, particularly on third downs and fourth downs, and that just didn't seem like that thought process was applied to that situation in a critical point in the game. The routes on the backside of it were a go route and a hitch versus press man-to-man. There was zero separation, and so it's one of those where you look and you go, yeah, I mean, could Watson – maybe have made a play, could have held on the football a little bit longer and found an open receiver. But it wasn't the clean look. Scheme, play call, none of that was an advantage to the situation. And you've got to have everybody's got to be the play caller, the design, the quarterback, the route. All of that has to be executed at a high level for you to have the advantage in fourth and one types of situations. A couple plays later, a couple plays earlier, I guess, was on the fumble. Deshaun's looking hard left, and there's nothing there. And then Hopkins is coming wide open on the backside, crossing the middle, coming into the quarterback's view, and Watson doesn't get back to him. They just left a lot on the field in a critical situation. I mean, both from a play-calling standpoint to an execution standpoint, they left a lot on the field early in that football game, and it cost them.
I don't know to be encouraged by that or discouraged by that.
Well, you got to be discouraged when it's week 11 or 12. I mean, it's one of those things where I expect better on a fourth and one call from a design standpoint. You expect better week 11 or 12 from your quarterback from the ability to get through your progression. Protection was not a problem. It was they weren't rolling coverages to where it was confusing the quarterback. It should have been a very clean look, quick progression, quick read. Quick get through when you're talking about getting through the progression, and it just didn't happen. So I think you can probably pass the buck to the quarterback and the play caller and the designer and the planner. But when it's all said and done, it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable week 11 and 12.
Clint Sterner, Wade Smith, Jeremy Branham. Coming up next, Mason Rudolph issued an apology today. Was it really an apology? We go around the NFL next on Sports Radio 610. Clint Sterner, Wade Smith, Jeremy Branham. We go around the NFL. Mason Rudolph issued an apology today. We're going to play the sound in a moment. First off, he came to this little media scrum with copies of paper. Like, he was, I don't know what he was doing, but he had
copies.
He was
prepared, man.
He was prepared. He was prepared for his scrum with the media. Here's Mason Rudolph, the apology after the altercation with Myles Garrett.
To say the least, it was an unfortunate situation for everyone involved. I consider it a privilege, not a right, to be part of the NFL, to be part of a first-class organization representing the Rooney family and the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I fell short of that expectation last Thursday night. And how I played, I did not do a good enough job to help our team win the game. Looking back, on the final play of the game, or the second to last play of the game, I fell short of the mark there too. Should have done a better job of keeping my cool in that situation. And, in retrospect, I put Marquise Pouncey, probably one of the best teammates I've ever had in a tough spot, as well as my teammates. So, the way I saw it, on the final play of the game, with the game in hand the way it was, it had been, we had already lost two of our players to targeting penalties.
Hold on right there. Hold on. He's issuing an apology, and we're starting to see Rudolph kind of defend his actions a little bit. We already lost two of our players due to helmet-to-helmet injuries. Remember, the Browns did have one player kicked out of the game for helmet-to-helmet targeting violations and got thrown out of the game. So Mason Rudolph, you can tell he's starting to turn the conversation a little bit to his defense. Here's more Mason Rudolph.
Well, we had already lost two of our players to targeting penalties from the game. And as I released the ball, I took a late shot. Did not agree with the way he then, took me to the ground. And my natural reaction was just to get him off from on top of me. And again, I should have done a better job handling that situation.
Okay.
You handled his helmet.
What you did was handle his
helmet.
I'm not the smartest guy. We all know that. But if you're trying to get a guy off of you, why are you grabbing his helmet towards you?
Yeah.
I don't understand that part of it.
Yeah. He wasn't trying to get him off of him. He was trying to get the helmet off of his head. Period. He was trying to get the helmet off his head because he was mad at him. He was frustrated because he threw four interceptions and he had a terrible ball game, just like he just admitted in this, I don't want to call it an apology because I haven't heard an apology. I haven't heard an apology yet. Maybe he'll get to it. But yeah, he was just frustrated with the situation. And so he took it out on Myles Garrett. And so it's very interesting. Hopefully we can get to the apology. Keep going.
All right, Mason, keep going.
I have no ill will towards Myles Garrett. Great respect for his ability as a player. And I know that if Myles could go back, he would handle the situation differently. As for my involvement last week, there's no acceptable excuse. The bottom line is I should have done a better job keeping my composure in that situation, and it falls short of what I believe it means to be a Pittsburgh Steeler and a member of the NFL. So I understand there's going to be a few questions, but I think it's in the best interest of our team, my teammates, our coaches, to kind of move forward from this and move things on the Cincinnati Bengals and keep looking to try to stack some wins here. So
I never heard it. I'm sorry there, Smitty. Like, if I'm handling that situation, I think I'm in the wrongdoing. You know what I say? I say I acted poorly on Thursday Night Football. I'm sorry for my actions, and I'm here to answer all of your questions.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't hear any of that. So to me,
and blame Myles Garrett.
When I read the headline, it says he apologized. It's like, okay, headline maker, that's wrong. He did not apologize. What he said was he should have handled it better, which is true. He should have handled it better, and it's true. A lot of things he said. He put his offensive lineman, Pouncey, in a bad spot by the way he handled the situation. And now his center is going to be out for three games, and he's working on an appeal now too. But that wasn't an apology. That was it was an acknowledgement of some of the things that he should have done better, period. That's what that was. It wasn't an apology.
It was a written explanation of his point of view, from his point of view, right. is essentially what that was. I mean, there's nothing worse than a guy that a grown man that doesn't just take – responsibility and for his actions and the roles that he plays in certain incidences and just doesn't just move forward. Like, how do we move forward if you can't even accept the fact that you were acting a fool?
Bro, AB apologized. AB can apologize. Why can't Mason Rudolph apologize?
Let's give Rudolph 12 weeks to apologize, I guess.
I'm just saying, though. I mean,
give him 3 months. Man. It took AB 3 months. Maybe it'll take Mason Rudolph 2 months. So he's got a little bit of time to beat AB still.
I don't think it's coming, bro.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's coming. I mean, look, I'm not at all saying that Myles Garrett wasn't in the wrong, because he clearly was in the wrong. But Mason Rudolph also had some responsibility for what happened. Look, it's a scrap. It's a scrap. Crazy things happen in scraps. We get it. We know that happens and whenever you're having a fight. Just say, you know what? I acted poorly. End of story. And then it's over.
Well, it would be very easy to say, you know what? Hey, I threw four picks in a game. I got hit 8,000 times. I was extremely frustrated. It's a violent game. I was on edge. I took a hit that I thought was a little bit late, and I responded in a way that I should not have responded. I should have never went to the headgear of another player. There's rules in place to protect me. I should have allowed the refs to do their job. I apologize for the part that I played in allowing this situation to escalate to the point that guys are suspended for the rest of the season. My own players. And it wasn't difficult. It's not difficult to do what he should have done. I guess that's the point. For a grown man that's in the spotlight 24/7, that's a leader of a football team, whether he wants to be or not, he is because he's a quarterback. It's not that difficult to get up there and say what the hell you're supposed to say and what you should say, and you blatantly, obviously should say. It's not that difficult to do, and he failed once again.
And everybody else involved in the situation has said an apology, except maybe Pouncey. And I think Pouncey said, I don't apologize for anything because what I did, I did because 10 out of 10 times I'm going to protect my quarterback, which I don't think he has a reason to apologize.
The kick might have went a little too far.
Hey, listen, you know what he said? I went black. I blacked out. I don't even remember what happened. And the way he said it, I believed him. He went to a different place.
Yeah.
He saw his helmet get hit, and he saw his quarterback get hit upside the head with a helmet, and he lost it. And so, to me, there's nobody in that locker room that says, you know what? You handled that incorrectly, Marquise. You should have done it a different way. Like, no, he did what he was supposed to do. You're supposed to look out for your brother. And so, the whole situation was just bad all the way around. Everybody involved needs to go ahead and take ownership for what they did. And that's what Pouncey said. He said, I'm sure I'll get suspended. It is what it is. I wouldn't change what I did. You know what I mean? If you can own up to something, and I could disagree with how you feel about a situation, but if you stand your ground and you own up for something and say, you know what, I did this, this is why I did this, and let's move forward, then we're cool. But it's a lot of hemming and hawing and well, it was because, you know, this and that and that. Come on, Mason, just own up to it. You messed up. You want to apologize now, and then we can move forward.
It's all it takes.
And that's all it takes. It's okay. It's okay. Everybody messes up. Everybody makes mistakes. Nobody's perfect. And you weren't perfect in this situation. Even though you keep pointing the finger at other people, you made a mistake in this too. And so you need to own up for what you did. And I didn't hear it.
The Steelers, by the way, are accusing the NFL of suspending Pouncey 3 games so he would miss the Cleveland game, which you can might kind of understand why the NFL would do that, although you don't want to mess with the pocketbooks of Marquise Pouncey. Also, Myles Garrett, he had his appeal today. Dan Graziano of ESPN reporting that the argument for Myles Garrett's appeal is that Antonio Smith got 2 preseason games plus 1 regular season game for swinging his helmet when he was a Texan at Richie Incognito. There was also an incident instead of the 6 games that he got. So they're using their primary defense in the Myles Garrett suspension of what a former Texan did, Antonio Smith the Ninja, when he got 2 preseason games, 1 regular season game for swinging the helmet at Richie Incognito. I still think the NFL is going to stand pat at the 6 games for Myles Garrett. Potentially more. I think it'll end after the regular season.
I think they stand pat as well. I mean, I think there's a different. I saw the highlight of the play. You're exactly what you're talking about, and I think it appeared to me that in that play it was a knee-jerk reaction to the helmet coming off of whether he swung it or threw it back at Incognito. It happened very, very quickly. I mean, just bang, bang. And that's one of those where I think anybody that's ever played the game understands that the knee-jerk reaction to do things is sometimes out of your control immediately. But when it's as calculated as what Myles Garrett did, even though that's in the heat of the moment as well, But you can see Myles Garrett almost gather his thoughts and gather his composure and then lose it again. There's no doubt that's – I think what we saw Myles Garrett do is beyond what we've ever seen in the NFL. And so, therefore, I think the suspension will be upheld to a degree of being the worst in the NFL to this point.
Well, I think the 6 games will stay, but I don't think they're going to move it into the next season. That's unprecedented, and I think that using the Antonio Smith defense – is something that I think is going to force the NFL to kind of come to the table and say, you know what, you're done for the rest of this season, but going forward next season, you're going to have a clean slate as far as you're going to be able to be a normal citizen per se as an NFL athlete going into the 2020 season. And I think that's reasonable. I don't think that should be something that's held over his head for a poor decision that he made in the heat of the moment. It wasn't like he chased Mason Rudolph down and hit him with the helmet. That would have been something different. Mason Rudolph was running at him when he hit him with the helmet, and he was totally wrong for doing that. But I think it's just the circumstance of the situation. To me, 6 games makes sense, and I think anything more than that you're just doing too much.
Clint Smitty, JB, going around the NFL. You guys remember the all-time 50 greatest players in the NBA deal that they did for the 50th anniversary of the NBA?
Indeed, indeed.
The NFL is doing the 100 all-time team, and they're starting to announce it on Friday. They're going to do it. They're going to do a show, a one-hour special, every Friday night through December 27th, and they're going to start to unveil the top 100 football players of all time to be on this NFL Top 100 team, and they're going to release it position by position. I believe the first episode is on Friday, and they're going to do running backs. It's going to be an hour show, and it's going to be co-hosted by Rich Eisen, Bill Belichick, and Chris Collinsworth. And they had a bunch of different folks that voted on the Top 100. They had league voters. They had coaches, like Belichick is one of the coaches. They had player personnel, like Gil Brandt, Charlie Casserly, Bill Polian, is part of the voting committee for this Top 100. They also had former players. They have some media members as well. They're going to have 10 offensive players, 12 running backs, 10 receivers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a really cool deal that the NFL is doing. And I'm curious on Friday if we have Earl Campbell be one of the 10 running backs in the top 100 list. That'd be a lot of fun to see as a Houston Oiler fan, as a Houston football fan, period. But that's going to be a cool deal that the NFL is doing starting on Friday with the 24 candidates, 24 nominees for running backs, and they'll limit it down to 12 on the all-time team.
Yeah, when you look at the names that are on the list, you got Marcus Allen, Jerome Bettis, Jim Brown, Earl Campbell, Earl Dutch Clark, Eric Dickerson, Tony Dorsett, Marshall Faulk, Red Grange, Franco Harris, Lenny Moore, Marion Motley, Bronco Nagurski, Walter Payton, Adrian Peterson, Barry Sanders, Gale Sayers. There's a bunch of big-time names on this list. But when I look at the list, you didn't want to say
O.J. Simpson. You stopped at O.J. Simpson.
Oh, did I? It had nothing to do with it. I actually skipped over him because I said I did skip over it. Whatever. But, yeah, it wasn't because of that. I look at the list, and I think that, you know, Earl Campbell deserves to be in this list. He's in the top 12 guys. And there's a lot of guys that I think really should be on the list. Like a guy like Jim Brown is going to make it. You know, Eric Dickerson is going to make it. Marshall Faulk is going to make it. Bronco Nagurski, Walter Payton, Barry Sanders, O.J. Simpson, Emmitt Smith, those guys are going to make LaDainian Thomas, and I think that Earl Campbell is right there with him. And so that's a pretty cool deal. If you are even in a finalist of this list, that is a huge accomplishment to make that list. And so now to actually make the top 100 and to have, you know, Earl Campbell, the Tyler Rose is going to make the list, I think, that's a pretty cool deal for people around Houston to follow on Friday.
I wonder how big of a deal this becomes, because like whenever we debate all-time great basketball players, that's one of the conversations you have, NBA championships, MVPs, and then sometimes you hear, well, he was one of the 50 greatest players of all time. So I wonder whenever we debate NFL football players in 10 years, 20 years, if we look back and say, well, he was an NFL top 100 member, and add that to the accolades of whenever you're shooting the you-know-what around wherever you're at with your buddies, yep, and debating former players and, you know, position groups and et cetera, if this is something we talk about in a decade. I hope so, because I like talking about that with the NBA. I think it'd be great to have that sort of thing for the NFL.
I think it's no doubt that if you're sitting around talking about running backs, I think if you are talking about Earl Campbell, he's in the top 12. I don't think you mention top 100 like you do in basketball. I think you mention top 12 running backs of all time. You know, I think you break it down to that extent, but nonetheless, it's super cool to have Earl Campbell on that list.
Did you see the odds for Cam Newton's next team? I know we've talked about Cam Newton the last few weeks because of the injury. Kyle Allen taking over in Carolina. We don't know if Cam Newton's going to be back with the Panthers. The latest odds, the Chicago Bears are the betting favorite, +250 to have Cam Newton on their roster next year. The Bengals +300, Panthers are +400. So if you're a betting man, or at least you respect what they do out in the desert, you believe the guys in Vegas, it looks like Cam Newton's not going to be a Panther next year, and he could be the heir apparent to one Mitch Trubisky.
Yeah, look, to me, this is an interesting topic, man, because what is Carolina going to do? I think Kyle Allen is a guy that's not going to be the face of your franchise. I think he's proven that he's a quality backup in this league for the right game plan, the right scheme around him. He's earned himself some money to be a quality backup in this league, a guy that a team can depend on to come in, get you in and out of the huddle, not make too many mistakes, although he's, as a starter, he's starting to make some mistakes. People are starting to figure out what he does well, starting to take that away, make him do different things, and he's struggling a little bit. I do believe that he's a guy that'll be a good backup in this league. The question is Carolina's under new ownership. Ron Rivera's never put two seasons back-to-back of 500 or better football. They're sitting at 500 right this second. Cam Newton's old, getting older. He's struggling throwing the football. You know, I think if Cam Newton stays in this league, it's highly likely that it's in a system like a Baltimore type system. I think that would be. Let me rephrase that. I don't think it's highly likely that he's in this league any longer. I think he's done. We've talked about it before. I've made that statement. But if he were to play football in this league again, I think the only way it happens and he wins is if they build the offense around his strengths and not say, well, he's up in age, he's been banged up, and so we don't want to run the football with him. He's not winning from the pocket, my man.
The injury report for the Texans is out. Three questionables and three players who have been ruled out for tomorrow's game. The three questionables, Bradley Roby, Tayshaun Gibson, Will Fuller, the three guys that are out for tomorrow night, Justin Reed, Lonnie Johnson Jr., and Mike Adams. What is the impact of that for the Texans on Thursday Night Football? That's next on Houston Sports Leader, Sports Radio 610.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.